But the fact of the matter is, what's happening today is no different than what's been happening all year, and it's just more of the same, and it's not one side or the other. It's the world that we live in, and it's the way it is. And we as Christians better get the memo sometime or another. The answer is not in Washington, D.C. It never has been, it hasn't been, and it's not going to be next year either. The answer is far above Washington, D.C., and it's what we're looking at tonight. See, as people, as we go through the life that we live in this world as Christians, we need to be like a car driver. If you learn to drive a car, one of the first things that you discover is you don't pay attention to the windshield. If you're staring at what happens right in front of the car, the ride in your car is going to be very jerky because you'll literally be responding to everything at the very last second as it occurs right in front of you. And that's a very choppy, risky, and dangerous ride. When you drive, the way to get somewhere smoothly and safely is to do what? You look out to the horizon. You look far ahead of you so you see what's coming up and you know how to react, how to respond, and when to turn well before the turn comes. As Christians, we need to stop riding the roller coaster of the political world. We need to stop staring at the dashboard of our everyday life, and we have to look well into the future at what is going to happen in the future to the whole pile of mess and realize we're going to get there. And there's a way to get there with peace and confidence in our hearts every single day of our lives. And a lot of that is found in the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation is given to us by God to help us be Christ-centered, to give us a chronological view of what's going to happen at the end of time, and to give us a pastoral message that helps us to persevere and have peace and confidence in our trials and suffering in this life. Tonight, we're looking at Revelation chapter 11, verses 15 to 19. And by the time we're done with this little passage tonight, we can effectively say we are halfway through the book of Revelation. The end of chapter 11 is the midpoint in the entire book. And so that in itself is some encouraging progress because Revelation is a big and imposing book. Revelation chapter 11, verses 15 through 19 tell us at last when the seventh trumpet is going to blow. Now, you know, so far in this book, we've looked at a series of judgments. The seal judgments followed by the trumpet judgments. We're going to look at the bowl judgments. Each of these set of judgments consists of seven. Seven seal judgments. A seal will be broken. A judgment will be unleashed. Seven of them. Seven trumpets will blow after that, and a judgment will come out of each trumpet blown. And then there'll be seven bowls that are dumped out on the earth, and a judgment will come out of that. But in between each of these seven series of judgments will be an intermission in the book of Revelation. That doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be a break in the action on earth, but there's a break in the action in the way that John is describing it to us as the writer. And so he's giving us a dramatic pause so that we can breathe and catch the action and soak in some other things that are either A, going on behind the scenes in heaven that we didn't see happening in the judgments on earth, or B, something that gives us a larger paradigm from which to view what we're reading. In another way, these intermissions help us to pause and to soak in the action of what's going on so that we are then ready to go with the next series of judgments that are about to come. As we go through the book of Revelation, each set of judgments is more severe and more comprehensive, more devastating. At the same time, as we go through, the intermissions and the break in the actions also get a little more long and lengthy. And so you have this increasing intensity, but you also have this increasing delay at the same time. It's an interesting dramatic effect. Another thing to note is now that we're coming to Revelation 11, verses 15 to 19, and if you look on the slide here, you'll see that we're looking at a slide we've seen before in a previous Wednesday night Bible study, but I've added a column, second from the right, Revelation 12, 1 to 14, 20. The passage we're looking at tonight is the seventh trumpet judgment, and you could place that from a dramatic sequence, the way the book lays it out, in between the strong angel section and the woman, child, and dragon section, 11:15 and 12:1. It go right between there, our passage tonight. That's the seventh trumpet. So essentially, chapters 10:1 to 11:14 set up the seventh trumpet. They build anticipation in an electrifying and dramatic way. They introduce us to the two witnesses that will be serving God as his mouthpieces on earth for 3.5 years, second half of the tribulation. And then we finally get to trumpet number 7. Trumpet number 6, we read about that back in chapter 9 and verse 13, and we haven't heard about trumpet 7 since then. And now we finally get to trumpet number 7. Now, what's interesting again, and we'll get into our passage tonight, is I mentioned the intermission between the seal and trumpet judgments. I also mentioned the intermission between the trumpets and the bowls, which is technically an interruption between the sixth and the seventh trumpet. But once the seventh trumpet blows in our passage tonight, you're going to see that nothing new actually happens. Technically, instead of action and judgment falling from the sky, what we actually see, for the most part, is just a grand announcement of something that's now going to happen. And that reminds us again of the way that the seventh judgment functions in each sequence. The seventh seal, when it breaks, actually introduces the seven trumpet judgments, not a judgment all by itself. And so when the seventh trumpet blows, guess what? It doesn't necessarily unload a judgment so much as it unloads the next series of judgments. It's telescopic. And so tonight we're going to see the seventh trumpet blowing, and then it takes all the way until chapter 15 for the bowl judgments to be set out and poured out. So we're in for tonight a little bit of a false rise in the action. We're going to get a teaser tonight. We've been put off for a while. What is the seventh trumpet? We finally get it tonight, but then we have to wait again to find out what actually happens. Why? Why do we get yet another intermission? We've already had one. So you can see now that the intermission and the pause, the dramatic lengthening between the seventh trumpet and the woes, the bowl judgments, is now going to be much longer than the one that was between the seal and trumpet judgments. Now that the judgments are getting more short and rapid in their intensity and length, why is the dramatic description getting longer? And I think a good reason for that, from a literary standpoint, is simply from God's vantage point, and then John writing, this is the moment. The seventh trumpet blowing is the moment that all of redemptive history has been climaxing towards, building towards. This is it. And so this is not something to just kind of rush through. This is something to, and I'll use words I've used before, to let sink in, to see and to savor with all of your heart. This is nothing for us to be scared of, because we are believers. We are on the right side of this story. But we need to know what's going to happen so we can see it and savor it for ourselves. And that will enable us to persevere through our suffering now. This is something that if we keep our eyes on it in the future, will prevent us from riding the dips and the turns of the roller coaster we're on right now if we watch Fox and CNN every day of our lives. Let's look at the future, not at the immediate crazy events. So that's what we're doing tonight. So tonight, we're not going to get to see the seven bowl judgments, though they're going to be announced, technically. We're not going to see any great judgments quite yet. And even after we hear this study tonight, we still have to wait two more chapters to get to those things. In that section from 12:1 to 14:20, we're going to get what some people say all of Revelation is, which isn't true, but what some of it is, and that is allegory. We're going to get some allegorical description of the big picture of what's been happening in a spiritual, behind-the-scenes sense from the beginning of time to today. It's the big meta-narrative of the Bible, the overarching story. And it has three main characters, a woman, a child, and a dragon. That sounds like something out of science fiction today, doesn't it? Or children's fiction. But it's God's way of telling us in a very gripping fashion what has been going on in history from a spiritual standpoint. We're also then going to get another description of two beasts. One is going to arise out of the earth. We've already seen that foreshadowed. And one is going to come out of the sea. And we're going to get a description of these two wild, vicious beasts. And then we're going to get this extended warning to Babylon, this world system. It's an economic and religious system. You could throw in political as well. That has been destroying the earth. It's what's going on today in our country, but what's been going on in our country for the last year, last 4 years, last 12 years, last century, the Civil War, it's the history of the world. Babylon has been destroying the world, and all of its players have been going along with that. But we are part of a different story, and that's what we're looking at tonight. Let's take a look at this passage, Revelation 11, verses 15 to 19. You're going to see some familiar characters here as well. Then the seventh angel sounded, and there were loud voices in heaven saying, "The kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever." And the 24 elders who sat before God, they haven't shown up for a while. Here they are again. They fell on their faces and worshiped God, saying, "We give you thanks, O Lord God Almighty, the one who is and who was and who is to come, ours say, because you have taken your great power and reigned. The nations were angry, and your wrath has come, and the time of the dead, that they should be judged, and that you should reward your servants, the prophets and the saints, and those who fear your name, small and great, and should destroy those who destroy the earth." Then the temple of God was opened in heaven, and the ark of his covenant was seen in his temple. If you are an Israelite from the Old Testament, you would be shocked by that. I get to see the ark of the covenant in the temple? Well, here it is. "And there were lightnings and noises, thunderings, an earthquake, and great hail." Then the seventh angel sounded, and there were in heaven loud voices. Here in this opening to the seal, or the seventh trumpet, John hears loud voices in heaven that are announcing some encouraging news. And so he's resuming his description of the seven trumpet judgments, picking up from Revelation 9:13. And then he says that there were loud voices in heaven. That's where these were at. He doesn't tell us who these were, and so we're probably very safe to assume that these are all the loud voices we were introduced to in Revelation 7, 9 through 11, the great uncountable multitude of angels and saved people who have been brought to heaven, and the 24 elders and the two four-faced creatures that lead worship at the throne in heaven, all of these people and spiritual beings, all with loud voices. We should think of this thing that John heard as not this great outburst of a trained, practiced, rehearsed choir saying this line one time, all in unison at once. Ta-da! Instead, we should think of a large stadium, a crowd filled with all kinds of people chanting and saying this repeatedly over and over again with excitement and enthusiasm. That's how we should envision this. That's how this is described. And quite frankly, this is the opposite of what happened at the end of the seven seal judgments. Between the seal and trumpet judgments, there was dead silence for the space of half an hour. Now, there is loud, incredibly loud, chanting of the victory that is about to come. So you can see the drama and the excitement, the enthusiasm building. You also can see, I think, not less of a hesitancy and a wondering what's going on to a full confidence. We know where this is going. This isn't the third inning where you're really not sure if your team has any chance. This is like the ninth inning where you know you've got a lead and you're going to win. And you're not just winning a game. You're going to win the championship. It's real. For a Mets fan, you don't even know what that's like. These loud voices are chanting, "The kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever." This is a triumphant chant, and it describes triumph for the Father and the Son. Our Lord here is being used in more of that Old Testament prophetic sense of referring to God the Father and his Son, or his Messiah. Here the word is his Christ being the Messiah, his anointed one that he sent into the world, who also is God. This is Christ, who as God's anointed one came into the world the first time. And if you recall his triumphal entry, he went into Jerusalem with the chants surrounding him. Everyone expected him to be anointed as the Son of David, who would finally come in and sit down on that throne and take over forever. And he went in, and that didn't happen. He was crucified instead. The suffering Messiah, that was his work in his first coming. But this time, the chance will not be confused people on the sides of the street in Jerusalem who will then, days later, be chanting, "Crucify him." These are crowds of those who have been redeemed from all time in heaven, joined together with the angels of heaven, chanting, "The triumph has come. He is now going to reign and rule forever." And so this is not chants of a lamb marching to a cross. These are the chants for a lion marching to the throne. And it's interesting, there is a question here, and I'll mention another one that's very fascinating tonight as well. There's a question about one of the words. Now, the word, "the kingdoms of this world have become the kingdom of our God," there are a few manuscripts that have this, kingdoms, plural. But the oldest manuscripts and the majority manuscripts have a singular form. The kingdom of this world has become the kingdoms of our God, which, if that's really what it is fascinating, because what it indicates is a unification of the kingdoms of this world into one, and then in one move, God from heaven takes that kingdom and makes it his. Satan will attempt to unify the world against God, and God will take that unification and use it for himself to conquer the world. It's kind of like when you're playing Risk and one person collects the armies from all the other teams, and then it's you versus that one person, and then you beat them and you get all the armies because they united themselves first, and then you come in and conquer them. And so he will make the kingdom of this world his kingdom forever. This have become is referring to what is about to happen in the seven bowl judgments that are about to occur. At this point in time, Christ will finally become the Davidic king who will sit on the throne of David and take the kingdoms of the world for himself. And this will happen forever. It will be an endless throne. This is one of the problems of following headlines of this world, or studying world history for that matter. Whether you're dealing with a democracy or a monarchy, whether it's through the electing process or the parliamentary process or the monarchical process, which means people die and new people become a king. Rulers change all the time. Once Christ sits down on the throne, friends, take a sigh of relief. It's never going to stop. He's going to sit there forever. That's peace. That's rest. I don't care what happens in this world to a certain degree. I mean, I care in a certain sense. I want to live my life without too much problem. But at the end of the day, I expect difficulty and suffering. I know what's going to happen to the end. And my king is going to sit down and he's never going to stop reigning. That's really all that matters, right? That's really all that matters. And that's, I think, the beauty of how this ends. The kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. What else is there to say? There's nothing more to say. Just say that again, will you? Just keep saying that, because there's nothing more to add to that beautiful declaration. Well, then, after this is said by these loud and uncountable voices, the 24 elders foreshadow even more encouraging news. They give us more details and more things to think about and to savor about this coming reign by the Messiah. These are the 24 inner angelic council members at God's throne. These are trusted council-type angel beings that surround the throne of God. And that position does not indicate God needs help ruling the world any more than he needs us to do it. He simply puts them there to glorify himself. These are wise and powerful beings, and he's trusting them with this very important role. But I think there's something very special recognizing that these creatures, the most trusted angelic creatures in all of the world, spiritual world, fall before him and worship, and then say what they're about to say. They did this also in Revelation 4 as well. This is significant in part because there was one trusted angel who did not worship, but rebelled. And that was the seed of the problems that we deal with today. And he took others with him. At this point, I think it is instructive to note that the angelic world on the side of heaven is united in their worship and service to God. And they are now also persuaded, for sure, this is the way to go, and this is where our lot is cast. There's no question about that. And so what they're about to say is demonstrating that even they are in full submission to Christ and God and what he is about to do. Here, God is called by these 24 elders the Almighty. And this is a phrase that occurs 9 times throughout the book of Revelation, from Revelation 1:8 to Revelation 21:22. And online, where I post my notes, I give you all of the 9 references if you want to look that up. There's only one other place this word refers to God is used in the New Testament, and that is in 2 Corinthians chapter 6. This word refers to God as omnipotent, all-powerful, and yes, almighty. In some languages, one Bible dictionary says the Almighty was a title for God that expressed the idea that he is the one who controls everything, the one who commands all people and all things. He's in charge of literally everything, and he has power over literally everything. Then it describes him, they describe him as the one who is and who was. I want to make a point here that is potentially helpful. King James, New King James, modern English versions, they add this phrase, and is to come. But again, the oldest manuscripts and the majority, by far, of other manuscripts don't have that phrase. Why would that not be there? And the evidence is heavily, heavily, heavily weighted in that side. If you look at the book of Revelation, and this is very interesting. If you look at the book of Revelation, chapter 1 and verse 8, and chapter 4 and verse 8, the same threefold statement is made. The one who is, and who was, and who is to come. Revelation 1:8 says that about Christ. Revelation 4:8 says that again about Christ or God the Father or both. Why would the third part not be there now? And again, there is very significant evidence that it would not be. There's very few manuscripts of any kind that say that it actually goes there. Let me tell you. Because he came. That's the whole point of this section. Now, there's a good reason why some scribes along the way might feel the urge to, oh, I think this got left out, and kind of put it in there to make sure it's complete. Because it was there in chapter 1, it was there in chapter 4, but it's not there here. And you have the same difficulty again in Revelation 16. Similar challenge comes up there. Because here, Christ has come. He is coming. The one who will come, the one who is coming is being announced, is being foreshadowed, and now here he is. That is fulfilled. I think there's a beautiful, potentially insight here that is just a part of what John is saying with incredible detail and carefulness. You say, does that mess up the eternality of God being made here in this threefold statement? And the answer is clearly no, because right in this passage, he is called the Almighty who will reign forever and ever. There's no problem there. He has come, and that is the point. He has now come. This is the climactic moment that all of redemptive history has been building up to. Because, John says, you have now taken your great power and you have reigned with it, is the idea. Meaning he has taken all that he is and finally went ahead and brought that to bear. He has graciously withheld his right to rule and reign for a while so that souls will come to salvation and his redemptive purposes will be complete and that the purification of Israel will come to pass as Daniel's 70 weeks prophecy tells us. There's a purging, a purifying, a filtration that has been going on throughout God's purposes and his plans, but now that is done. And with the pouring out of the seven bowl judgments, it will be complete, and he will have come to rule and to reign. Now, John goes on to say what is going to happen. He says here that the nations were angry. That's not hard to imagine, is it? Is it hard to imagine how angry people could get when someone tells them they're going to be in charge and not them? I'm going to take the reins of power, thank you. Is it hard to see why, how people could get angry? Now, the nations here were angry. This describes the pagan, secular, religious, non-believing peoples of the world who are going to respond to this climactic moment with anger. And then it says, and your wrath has come. Interestingly enough, the word they were angry is the same word as your wrath has come. In a sense, it's saying they were enraged and you were enraged. When the nations of the world are angry at God, it is a wicked anger. But when God is angry at the wicked world, it is a holy anger. That's what John is describing. Right now, there is a secular, humanistic, atheistic, agnostic, whatever you want to call it, sinful attitude towards God that pervades our society. But it is nothing at all compared to what this is going to be like. Because right now, a lot of our anger is towards each other. One side is angry at the other, and that side is angry at the other, and they say it's for God and whatever, and they say it's for the people and whatever. There's a lot directed at each other, but there's coming a day when the nations of the world will unite together and all their rage will be directly thrown towards God. And God will throw all his anger towards them. And there'll be no confusion about who's in that group. It'll be a unified group. So this anger will be back and forth. And it says, and the time of the dead that they should be judged will arrive. This moment will end in this way, and the dead of all time will be judged. That will be one of the results of this final climactic moment when Christ comes. He will judge the world. And in judging, he will judge those who have been dead throughout the history of the world. And then it tells us of two groups. He will reward his servants, and he will destroy those who destroy the earth. The elders describe God's servants as both the prophets and the saints. Prophets refers to his chosen spokesmen throughout history, Old Testament prophets, New Testament apostles. It's a small group of people that have dotted his redemptive landscape throughout time and spoken revelatory messages on his behalf. And this will also include the witnesses we've just learned about in the tribulation as well. But then, the word saints refers to all the rest of God's people, generally, who have followed him and persevered in their faith and their response to the message of the prophets. And so he describes his prophets as his servants and his people as those who fear God's name. As servants, he underscores how the prophets devoted themselves in full loyalty to speaking God's words for him against great pressure to do otherwise. It is really hard to stand up against a mob of people and do what is right. It's hard, especially when those people are supposed to be God's people. Especially when the king you're serving is supposed to be reigning for God and he's not, and you have to tell him no. And John the Baptist got his head cut off for doing that. It's not easy. And so these men get special notice in this moment, and they are called God's servants, not the servants of this world. But then those others of us, his saints, his people of faith throughout history, are called those who fear God. Again, underscoring, these are people, and I trust that is us as well, who have chosen to fear God, not man. And we live our lives by a higher power, God himself, that triumphs over the kingdoms of this world. Like Peter himself said in the book of Acts, I will pay my taxes, I will be a good citizen, but at the end of the day, I must obey God rather than men. God is here speaking about those people who have made that decision. True followers of Christ make that decision. I will follow God rather than men. And in the end, though it will be difficult for many who make that choice, you will be rewarded. You will not get the Presidential Medal of Honor in this life, but you'll get what God has coming for you in the next. And that one is forever. And then he adds to this, the small and the great. John does this he does this five times throughout the book, actually. He likes this phrase, the small and the great. Small and the great may refer to children and adults who believed on Christ, but that's probably just a subsection of the larger point that John makes when he says this, referring to the least significant to the most significant, according to human standards, the way that this world grades people. The idea is this, that whether you were wealthy or poor in this life or middle class, whether you were powerful or oppressed, important or unimportant, free or enslaved, Jesus Christ is going to reward your faithfulness and your service to him, your suffering, your perseverance for him, regardless of what kind of status you held in this world. Rich people will not get judged more harshly. Poor people will not get judged more graciously. Poor people will not be judged more harshly, and rich people with more favor. He will not do that. He will simply look at you as a human being, and he will judge you based upon your faithfulness and perseverance to his cause. Did you fear him? And how did you do that? That is all he's going to look at. He will be status blind. That's also reassuring, isn't it? It means I don't have to worry about my status in this life. It is irrelevant as far as the kingdom of God is concerned. I don't have to try to get out of my status. I don't have to feel bad for my status. I don't have to try to climb and improve my status. I need to focus on my eternal status. Do I know Jesus Christ as Savior? And if I do, then I persevere through suffering now. I serve him now. I fear him now. And he will judge me righteously in the end. That is all I need to worry about. That's reassuring. This world doesn't think that way, does it? And then it says, and he will destroy those who destroy the earth. It looks like this doesn't get as much of attention, but trust me, it's going to get a lot of attention in the next few chapters. But what does this refer to? He will destroy those who destroy the earth. Today, you might feel like, oh, this is speaking about ecological justice. This is talking about God letting us know that he is going to judge those who throw their plastic bottles out their car window without regard for the planet. That's not exactly what's going on here. What he's doing here is he's using some terminology that was used of Babylon in the book of Jeremiah and the prophetic literature, the destroyer that destroys the earth. Here in the book of Revelation, in the next chapters, we're going to get a good look at this. Revelation 19, true and righteous are his judgments because he has judged the great harlot who corrupted the earth with her fornication and has avenged on her the blood of his servants shed by her. We're going to find, we don't have time to talk about it tonight, it will be expanded in the next chapters of Revelation, that John is referring here to this world system called Babylon the Great. That is an economic, religious, political mess, a system that has, get this, exploited the earth for sinful purposes rather than do what we were made to do in the first place, explore the earth to glorify God in his purposes. Genesis 1:28 tells us we're to be fruitful and multiply, replenish the earth and have dominion over it. We're to make the good world that God made very good even better. We're to explore, to expand his glory in the world. but instead we've exploited it and destroyed it for our purposes. Technically, throwing your plastic bottle out the window is not a good thing to do as God's servant. I don't care what your political views are. That is not a good point to make. We should take care of the world and be sensitive to the environment. But that's not exactly, that's a very low-level point here. That is not exactly what's being spoken of. It is the much broader issue, the political, religious, and spiritual exploitation of people and this world for selfish, sinful purposes. That's the point. We are destroying what God made, and he will destroy those who are doing that. Question is, are you a part of that system? Are you a part of that process? Are you feeding it and fueling it? Or do you stand apart from it? Finally, this section closes with this interesting detail, that God will give open access to his presence. This seems kind of like a knee-jerk thing. We're reading about this scene in heaven, and then all of a sudden, bang, here's this temple and this Ark of the Covenant, and then we're off to the races on something else in the next chapter. But it's a small stop along the way with very special significance. I could actually take weeks just to expand the truths that are embedded in this one verse, and we're not going to do that. Otherwise, we would be in Revelation 4 years. Take a look at this verse. Then the temple of God was opened in heaven, and the Ark of his covenant was seen in his temple. Now to some, you might say, is this the Ark of the Covenant? And we're going to get into, okay, the Ark of the Covenant was buried deep into Sinai somewhere. It's going to be on Earth someday, and the red heifer is going to come out, and all these things are going to happen. And now this is talking about it was transported and teleported to heaven, and there it is. God beamed it up to heaven. No, that is not what's going on any more than the temple is somehow a temple on earth that was teleported to heaven. What this is talking about here is a temple in heaven, an Ark of the Covenant in heaven. This is really, really neat. Let me show you this. In Exodus 25:40, when God spoke to Moses, he said, "Make them," referring to the plans for the tabernacle, "according to the pattern which was shown to you on Mount Sinai." Okay? Now, notice what Hebrews tells us about this. It actually quotes from that. Hebrews 8:1-5 is the full passage. I'll just look at two of the verses on the slides. "The sanctuary and the true tabernacle which the Lord erected, not man." So the writer of Hebrews is saying that there is a temple that God actually made, and this temple is in heaven. He made it. No human being built this thing. Okay? Then notice what it says. That the tabernacle that God gave to Moses on Mount Sinai was a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. As Moses was divinely instructed when he was about to make the tabernacle. 4, the Lord said, "See that you make all things according to the pattern shown you on the mountain." And this is in this discussion of Hebrews 8, of this idea that there is actually a tabernacle and an Ark of the Covenant in heaven. And the tabernacle on earth and the Ark of the Covenant, the box with the cherubim on it, hovering, were simply given to Moses in a pattern. They were just copies in a limited way of the one that's in heaven. And John sees this thing, and he knows it's a temple, and he sees this thing, and he knows what it is. That's the Ark of the Covenant, because it looks like what I read about in the Old Testament. So whatever is on earth is kind of irrelevant when you compare it to the one in heaven. That's the good one, that's the real, that's the authentic, original Ark of the Covenant. You say, so why is this mentioned here? If you're an Old Testament Israelite, you would know, which John was an Israelite who had just come out of the Old Testament religion. The tabernacle, later on the temple, is where Israelites would congregate to worship the Lord and to fellowship, to have intimate access to his presence, to interact with him in a special way. They did not enjoy God's interpersonal presence as we do today to the same degree. But when they came, they would have to come with sacrifices to enter only the outer courtyard. They couldn't go into the actual tabernacle itself. Only the priests could go into the actual tabernacle itself after elaborate rituals of cleansing themselves and offering sacrifices as well. But even they could only go into the entry room, the opening area of the tabernacle. There was an inner room called the holiest place. And only the one singular high priest could go into that room where the Ark of the Covenant was, and God's focused presence was most intense and real, one time a year, at the risk of death, after many elaborate rituals, as the entire nation of Israel watched him go in to see what would happen. For John to see, not just, and that's just the tabernacle on earth, which is nothing compared to the one in heaven. It doesn't even compare. It's like it, but very much less important and significant. The one in heaven is the important one, and that's the one you would expect to have like multiple courtyards, right? You'd expect it to have multiple layers of access and security codes and security guards and piles of sacrifices and all kinds of, like, who in the world, if you can't get into the tabernacle that Moses built, how are you going to get into the one in heaven? And John looks, and the one in heaven is wide open, and the Ark of the Covenant is wide open, and anyone can go in. The restrictions are gone. To the Ark of the Covenant that really matters, the seat of God's presence over the universe. Wow. So John just, he mentions this, and we just see and savor that. Try to think about it like an Old Testament Jew. Wow, at first it catches you off guard. Why is the temple open? I can see the Ark of the Covenant. Why? That's kind of weird. You mean I can just go in? God is inviting open, intimate access to the seat of his presence, to his people. The prophets and the saints can now go in. Why? Well, you have to read the book of Hebrews to really unpack that. It's deep. But Christ has made the way as our priest and our sacrifice. So, following that, it says there were lightnings, noises, thunderings, and earthquake, and great hail. And here we are back to normal in Revelation. We get to go back down and see the weather patterns on earth, and they're not very pleasant. Interesting, though, Revelation 15 and 16 gives us the seven bowl judgments, which end this way. This is the near end of the tribulation period. This is after the seventh bowl judgment has been emptied out. Here's what it will say. There were noises and thunderings and lightnings and a great earthquake. And then notice what it says, Revelation 16:21, a couple verses later, and great hail from heaven fell on them. Which indicates what John might be looking at here after the end of this heavenly vision of the behind-the-scenes stuff going on. Is the same thing as what's going to happen at the end of the seven bowl judgments. So he might be kind of getting the behind-the-scenes heavenly look at something. And then we're going to kind of rewind and go back and see what was happening on earth. So this is a dramatic intermission, not necessarily a chronological one. Hope that makes sense. When we read the end of Revelation 16, we're effectively, it seems, reading the same thing that we're reading here. Only after reading about the judgments on earth. I think that's probably likely what's going on. Let's wrap up tonight. Two takeaways. The first takeaway I want to bring before us tonight is simple. I've alluded to it. That is, in the end, the only factor that will unite the world is mutual defiance against God. Stop our delusions of any other kind of unity in this world. The Antichrist will be the ultimate delusion. He will make it look like it actually was possible to pull off, and he will unite the world. But even then, it will not work. The only way he will unite the world in the end is when they gather together in massive armies in open, unified defiance, all people against the Lord. Right now, there's a lot of fighting we know about in our own country, right? It's back and forth, but there's coming a day, all sides. When Jesus Christ himself, remember this, came into the world. When you read the Bible for the first time as a young Christian and you get into the New Testament, you read about these Pharisees and these scribes and the Sadducees, and you think, this sounds like one big club. Who are these Sadducees and Pharisees? They're like buddies and they're all fighting against Jesus all the time. What we don't realize is that the Sadducees and the Pharisees were diehard opponents. In very many ways, the Sadducees were the liberal, social, sensitive, elite class. You can decide what party that's like today. In America, the Pharisees were opposed to them. They were the middle class, working class, conservative, traditional Jewish values, maintain our heritage and our roots. That was what they were. They were ultra strict to preserve the Jewish identity. The Sadducees would sell their souls just to get political positions. They were very liberal. They stopped believing in the resurrection. They just washed away a bunch of doctrines and kept a few so they still could be Jewish. But they gave up a lot to get. And so the liberal on one side, the conservative on the other. But what was so ironic was when Jesus Christ came onto the scene, it's like they were friends. And that's going to happen on a much greater scale when Christ comes from heaven to the earth to rule and to reign, not just to suffer. All political parties and factions and nations and people groups will unite in their mutual hatred of God. That's the only way to do it, is you have to stir up animosity towards Christ. Then you can unify people and get somewhere. That's how this world runs, right? Even in America. But that's okay. We know how that works. We know the end of the story. But the other part of this is, in the end, Christ will reign and will reward his people. In 1968, Super Bowl quarterback Joe Namath, if you're a Jets fan, you know who that is, he vowed before the season began that the New York Jets would win Super Bowl number 3. But if you know, there was no reason for anyone to believe that in the world. People thought he was nuts. Pundits and fans alike said there's no way. They ridiculed him. That's crazy. There's no way the Jets are going to win the Super Bowl. Decades later, that's probably still what people would say. The funny thing is, though, that they made it to the Super Bowl. They were 18-point underdogs, which is very awkward to be even in the Super Bowl and to be that much of an underdog. It should be closer than that. But everyone stopped ridiculing when the final score ended at 16-7 and the Jets won. We can read the book of Revelation, friends, and we know Christ wins. The world we live in doesn't make it feel that way, does it? It makes it feel like we're on the losing side of the story and we're getting beaten down, we're getting marginalized, and we're getting pushed to the fringe. We're being told all kinds of things that we're bad, that we're evil, that we're unloving, we're uncaring and unkind and all these, and sometimes we are, and we need to correct that. But in general, we are to represent Christ, and doing that in the most loving way possible will still draw those accusations. That's all right. People can ridicule us, but we know we're still going to win. And that's the purpose of Revelation, to instill that vision on the horizon into our hearts so the twists and turns of today don't rile us up. I want to finish tonight by reading Psalm 2, which is a psalm whose fingerprints are on all of end times prophecy, including what we're reading about right now. Psalm chapter 2. The short little psalm that nearly opens the Psalter. Why do the nations rage and the people plot a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us break their bonds in pieces and cast away their cords. He who sits in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall hold them in derision, and he shall speak to them in his wrath. This is what we're talking about tonight in this very passage we just looked at. And distress them in his deep displeasure. Yet I have set my king. He's taunting them. This is God talking. For all your plans. Yet I have set my king on my holy hill of Zion. Look at that. I will declare the decree. The Lord has said to me, you are my son. This is Christ now speaking. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will give you the nations for your inheritance. By the way, this is not a missions verse. This is an end times judgment verse. And the ends of the earth for your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron, and you shall dash them to pieces like a potter's vessel. The idea is this. The kingdoms of the world are this pottery vessel, and they think they're all something. And when it all comes down to it, Christ will come and, oops, drop them on the floor. Look at that. They just broke into a million itty-bitty pieces. Look at that. That's what he thinks about the kingdoms and their plans. Now, therefore, be wise, O kings. Be instructed, you judges of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear. Do you see the tentacles of this psalm in our passage tonight? And rejoice with trembling, the bittersweet nature of prophecy. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry, and you perish in the way. When his wrath is kindled but a little, blessed are all those who put their trust in him.